Hi, welcome to the Ecosystemic Futures Podcast. I'm your host, Tom Cook. After spending 24 years in the Air Force developing satellites and new operating methodologies, incorporating new technologies, I've been working with future of work, future of aerospace with NASA. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the fundamental frameworks within society, industry, economy, and policy, and reframing how we innovate and build for the future. In this podcast series, we are exploring these new ecosystemic impacts across every facet of society, from the future of education, work, agriculture, engineering, tech, aviation, and space, to name just a few. And today we'll be discussing microarchitecture with a product that can create food, jobs, building materials, and store carbon at the same time, and how this is reimagining the future of building materials and can impact greater ecosystemic wellness both in space and here on Earth. My co-host today is Vikram Shyam from NASA. Welcome, Vic.
Thanks, Tom. I'm Vic. I've been at NASA for 15 years. I'm currently the futurist for the Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. Got a background in propulsion, biomimicry, and foresight. And speaking of things that are ethic or bio-utilization focused and foresight, we're joined today by Chris Maurer, who has his feet in, I guess, both parts of those worlds. He's a pioneer in the field of mycelium. He's the founder and chief architect at Red House Studios, which is a firm based in Cleveland, Ohio. And he specializes in innovative architecture on Earth and in space. Welcome, Chris.
Great to be here today. Hi, Vic. Hi, Tom. As you noted, I'm an architect, and my studio, Red House, is engaged in some exciting work that uses living organisms to grow buildings. We call materials made from the growth of living organisms biomaterials, and they are very exciting to me as an architect because they can be extremely multifunctional and bioperformative, meaning they can do a lot of things that inert materials cannot.
That's fantastic, Chris. Can you give us some context around the history of the bioarchitecture and how it's creating a renaissance for building, as you mentioned?
Yes. Bioarchitecture, or using living organisms to fabricate the built environment, has been around for a little while and it spans many kingdoms of life. Researchers are looking at using bacteria to create a kind of living cement that can bind together inert materials like rock and sand, which can make concrete or brick alternatives that does not require high energy kilns. Some folks are cultivating algae that absorbs carbon dioxide and creating plastic alternatives from that are biodegradable. And our favorite type of biomaterial are mycoterials. They use fungal mycelium to bind loose organic substrates into solid materials that can be insulative, structural, fire-resistant, and at their end of life, completely compostable. You mentioned building renaissance, and I think that's a great way to look at it. Renaissance literally means rebirth, and the living organisms that are best known for creating life from dead matter are fungi. By harnessing living organisms, we can imagine a future where architecture is a life giver rather than destroyer of nature, as we see today.
So Chris, you noted that micromaterials, microarchitecture can help to reduce carbon emissions or mitigate carbon emissions, and there's also a regenerative aspect to it. So can you tell us a little bit more about this technology and how it's been advancing over the years?
Yeah, I think bioarchitecture generally can be a big force for regenerative ecosystems, and plants are mainly the ones that are known for absorbing carbon or drawing carbon down from the atmosphere and converting that into biomass. What happened traditionally, that carbon would then be focused into underground networks using fungi and other microbes that would disperse that into the ground. But when we started monocultures, we kind of divorced that system between plants and fungi, really capturing that carbon. And the plant waste is either, in some cases, burned, in some cases, metabolized, and other cases, it is just completely degraded into a way that releases that carbon back into the atmosphere. What mycotexture can do is actually repair those organisms together, the plants and the fungi, and by the plant drawing down carbon through its life cycle and then combining with the fungus, it becomes a solid material that then can be used in buildings. And then those building products are actually going to store the organic carbon. So that's one way that it can be regenerative. We're working on a project in Namibia that's actually using what they call the encroacher bush, there. And this is a bush that is choking wildlife refuge. It's absorbing natural aquifers. It's proliferated ever since the colonists started paying off land for cattle farming, and it changed the wildlife migration practices. Animals used to trample these bushes, but now they're proliferating and causing havoc to the ecosystem there. So the government of Namibia wants to thin that bush, which actually creates quite a lot of sustainably harvested biomass. Unfortunately, it's not great for building with this material. A lot of people really just see it as an opportunity to burn the bush to create energy, which is only going to release that carbon dioxide into the environment. But what we found is if you take that material and you use it to cultivate mushrooms by inoculating it with mycelium, you can, for every pound of bush that you use, you can get a pound of mushrooms, a pound of building material, and a pound and a half of carbon storage, because that material is now going to lock that carbon, organic carbon, into a thing that is not going to biodegrade and release that into the environment. So you get these three benefits from one, and the first order of business was to actually regenerate wildlife by thinning the bush. So it's actually four benefits. And so these are ways that we look at vertically integrating processes that can create these co-benefits, these co-synergies that at the end of the day could result in boundless growth because you're getting all of the positive aspects from these processes.
Go ahead, Vic, sorry.
Yeah, I wanted to focus a bit on what you said earlier about this network underground. Is that what lay people like myself would call I've heard this term called the wood wide web. Is that it?
Yeah, I think that might have been a Stamets quote. Paul Stamets is a very famous mycologist that likens the mycorrhizal networks, or these root fungi network, to the World Wide Web. He calls it the Wood Wide Web. It's also noted for having these similar aesthetics or connectivity to things like neurological networks or even cosmic networks. Since we're talking NASA here, there's so much in the way of the interconnectivity of this that seems to be very similar to a lot of
what
these,
is it
that's, we understand better.
What is it that's being connected together? What exactly is a network? Is it structural? Is it chemical? Is it sending signals?
It's a bit of everything, right? So the trees basically pull the carbon from the atmosphere, or plants pull the carbon from the atmosphere and drive it into the ground. And then fungi that pair with these will take sugars from the plants and give back nutrients from the ground, these trace nutrients that all life needs, things like nitrogen and phosphates, NPK. If you're a gardener, you might know about that. So a lot of these trace nutrients that the plant needs, they exchange these things, and it's a symbiotic relationship. But there's also the ability for trees to nourish other trees throughout the forest. So they can use this mycorrhizal network to actually not only pass things like nutrients from one tree to another, but there, some researchers say that passing information as well, signaling that, hey, there's a predator coming, starting to digest more of my leaves than I like. You should start producing more tannins so that this grazer or this browser won't attack you as well. And that they can actually change their physiology to create a adverse effect to whatever's bothering the other plant. It's really fascinating.
So when we're talking about these ecosystems above ground, then you're talking about using this kind of material in the architecture. Is there a potential for us to then create living architecture that's maybe the ecosystem itself is able to communicate the different components of the system? We're talking about health and regeneration and that kind of stuff.
I think so. One of the things that we're really excited about when it comes to biomaterials is the bioperformative aspect. So there is this communication aspect that I think is probably a little bit beyond the current technology. I think that there's a lot that needs to be understood about the way that plants, fungi, and others communicate. But there are things that we can immediately address with bioperformative aspects, and those are things like remediation. The pollutants that are in our environment, we can use things like the enzymatic action of fungal digestion to break down petrochemicals that are in the built environment. And we have a project called BioCycler where we're doing exactly that. We're taking construction and demolition waste and recycling that, and not only recycling it, but remediating it, because the fungi can break down these things like asphalt and bitumen and other hydrocarbons that are in the materials, break those down into sulfur, smaller molecule chains. And then when it comes to things like elemental toxins, things like heavy metals, like lead paints and cadmium and arsenic that are purposely put into the built environment that are poison, literally poison for the inhabitants. The mycelium and other biochelators can actually latch onto those and create them, make them so that they're non-digestible or non-bioaccessible. And those particles tend to get lodged in the cell wall of the mycelium, and that creates this encapsulation, this polymeric encapsulation that actually prevents that material from being bioabsorbed into organisms like small children that tend to have hand-to-mouth contact with the lead paint dust and become poisoned by them. So there's bioperformative aspects like that. And then our work with NASA, we're actually looking at the ability for growing buildings off planet, which of course is going to save a lot of transport costs. That's the main pitch that we have for this project being advantageous for NASA. But the other thing is that the bioperformative aspects of the fungi can do things like protect from radiation. There are certain types of fungi that are melanin rich that are actually have been shown to be able to transduce high energy radiation like you would find on the moon or Mars into lower forms of energy that are safe and possibly even convert that into biomass itself. And so you can see this as a way of leveraging NASA's biggest liability, which is this radiation, and converting that into an opportunity, things like a biomass to create materials from, and at the end of the day, possibly a protective shield for our space travelers. So there are these things that inert materials could never dream of being able to do, things like steel where it can transduce a material. That's something that only life can do. And that's why I think biomaterials are really exciting.
Well, I think what's really interesting to me is the discussion you had with the encroacher bush and then taking the remnants of that and bringing that back into an interconnected network where it then provides signaling and architecture and network. The first thing that came to my mind living here in Colorado was the tumbleweed, right? That encroaches on cars as they go out to Denver International Airport. Is there any similarities in any of the other things out there beyond encroacher bush that you've studied? And then I love what you just said about the anti-radiative properties for space travelers and habitats off planet. It could be lunar, it could be Martian, it could be space hotels that have been discussed. How do you encroacher bush or tumbleweed and then apply that back to Earth and then vice versa? And what are we learning from both space and Earth as you're doing projects that support both kind of forms here?
Yeah, I think it doesn't matter where you go, you're never going to have a shortage of problems, right? So the way that we look at this is to turn those problems into opportunities, and bioarchitecture can generally do that. In Namibia, it's the encroacher bush. We're able to use fungi to actually convert that in food and housing and store carbon at the same time. Off planet, we talked about radiation actually being a source for creating a new material, the biggest liability there, and then again being converted into something. Here in Cleveland, we have this glut of abandoned and blighted homes. And so that's why we're looking at actually converting the construction and demolition waste into new materials. And instead of making food in buildings, in this case, we're making remediation in building. And so the idea is that you have these remediative surfaces that are co-beneficial to the actual recycling of material. It's also diverting material from going to landfill, which creates greenhouse gases just by the degradation of the materials underground. So everywhere you go, you're going to find a problematic material. And a lot of times you can find a biological organism that can convert that into something positive. Nature finds a way, life finds a way to actually create something from nothing. And fungi are specifically geared for doing this. It takes dead matter and it turns it into new life, and at the end of that soil for further life to come from that. So you name it, harmful algal blooms, that's another thing where we're seeing is something that's choking wildlife refuge, and it's creating toxic effects to drinking water here in Lake Erie. That if we're able to harness that and actually use that as a substrate for creating both food and materials, that's another way to look at things. And there's always going to be something to clean up. And so nature and fungi specifically are one of the things that we're looking at for actually doing that and converting it to co-benefits at the same time.
So how do you go from your background in architecture to a molecular biologist? And how do the other folks that are out there that maybe not as familiar with your background, but to me, when I learned about your background, so there's some very different training skill sets that usually someone dedicates their entire life to in one of those areas and not both simultaneously. How do we impart that wisdom on other folks as far as like all these different materials that are human-made that some have been very long-lasting. Plastics are obviously a current concern. And as we've mentioned, we've kind of talked about sustainability versus regeneration. So how do we get folks knowledgeable about what are these harmful substances that are still out there? What are some of their actual beneficial uses in regeneration? And how do they become an architect / molecular biologist?
Yeah, I think to answer your question about how I kind of put these things together, we've always been transdisciplinary here, pulling in from different fields of art into our architecture. And biology is just, I think, one more discipline that can really be paired well with architecture. And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that buildings are responsible for 40% of the world's carbon emissions. I do feel this guilt as an architect designing things that have negative effects on the environment. We try and be as carbon neutral, as energy neutral as possible with all of our projects, but it's just challenging based on what materials we have to work with. And the cheaper materials tend to be the ones that are the worst for the environment. I worked for a number of years in Africa. I worked in Malawi and Rwanda and now in Namibia. And being in areas like that where resources are very limited was a good opportunity to really look at how you work with those limited resources and how you can convert those into co-benefits as you create things. And so we did a lot of work with earth construction, which, you know, was a good material because basically you're taking the ground and turning it into buildings. So there's not much of a carbon footprint there. But when I started learning about materials and companies that were making products out of mycelium and bacteria and things like that, I really saw that as an opportunity to not only start to change the adverse effects of architecture, but to actually look at this as a way of a regenerative architecture, a way that we can use this biology to do things like absorb carbon, to store carbon, to convert waste into useful materials. And so I think having that experience in a limited resource environment and then understanding that we're always in a limited resource environment, we just don't realize it here because we don't feel the effects as acutely of the damage we're doing with our building and architecture. That's one thing that kind of made me very interested in learning about biomaterials and converting some of that research that was out there into practice. And then, of course, doing our own research, working with folks at NASA like Vic and Dr. Lynn Rothschild at NASA Ames, and working with researchers at MIT like Dr. Andreas Merschen at the Center for Bits and Atoms, and taking some of these things that are in the literature and converting them into actual practice. And so that's what we do as architects, is we make things. And so we're designing and making things to actually prove some of the ideas that maybe have been around, but just haven't been put to practice yet.
Well, so Vic works for the Convergent Paradox Solutions Project. And me coming out of the military, we always talked about stovepipes and silos and trying to break those down, and IPTs and cross-product teams and that type of thing. How do you, it really talks to what you're just saying to me of this convergence, right, between disciplines. And to your point, here in the States, it does seem like, hey, if we can figure out a way to make a living, to make money a certain way, and I don't need to be collaborative in that way to bring in these types of convergent solutions that are actually better for all of us and not just for the individual or group of individuals collectively working in a siloed way. I guess one is, I mean, I think we are really seeing the benefit here of a convergent solution, but then how do you take that and demonstrate the value of one of our co-conspirators, Diane Finkhausen, I tell her she's coined this term, but structured serendipity, right? From having the structure necessary in a science of systems, as we've discussed in previous podcasts, and convergent solutions in maybe a networked effect, but not having necessarily a network in place to create all that in the first place. Because the biomimicry that Vic's worked on and what you discussed earlier today with networking the organisms as they come together that might not have been together before that new insertion. I find this just fascinating that you can take these disparate parts and find some connective tissue, and then all of a sudden you have this new living organism that has this new capability, this regenerative capability. Wouldn't have come forward if you didn't have some convergent kind of mindset.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what biomimicry is. And I owe a lot to Vic for some of these projects coming together because I met some of my collaborators at the biomimicry summits that he organized at NASA Glenn and the Vine Network, which is the virtual interchange for nature-inspired exploration. So biomimicry at its heart is learning from nature. And so nature is so complex and does so many operations all at the same time. You can't help but be inspired by those processes and seeing how complex everything is and vertically integrated. And our circulatory systems are marvels. And the fact that we can get oxygen to every cell in our body is really inspiring for why can we do that in architecture too? Can we have a series of cells that is connected by a system that can actually nourish each one of those cells and grow the bricks together to create a building? And that's exactly what we were trying to do with what we are trying to do with our NIAC project, which is for NASA to do self-growing off-planet structures. And it's designed as a package that is packaged small. And then when it gets to destination, it's met with water and gases that can actually have those living organisms inside of each one of those cells grow into large masses, large biomass that actually fills larger cavities. And then as each one of those cells grow, the building grows like an organism, exactly like an organism. And so that's a very biomimetic process, because basically we're saying that this building is going to grow the same way that organisms grow. But at its heart, not only does the blood get oxygen to each one of its cells, but it's the thermal regulation for your body as well. And it transports all of the antibodies that need to attack and that get into your body. So all of these things are super complex and developed over billions of years. And to take just one part of that and to turn that into a piece of architecture that is already starting to change the game. But if we were to look at nature closely and see a multifunctional, each one of these systems are, that's where we're really going to make a difference. And so that's when we say we want to take the encroacher bush and we want to create food from it and building materials. What else can we do? We can store carbon. We can have this regenerative system of bush thinning in the same process. And so we start to align all of those ships in the same direction. And by doing that, you create a system that is regenerative. The hard part is getting paid for for all of those aspects, right? And so there are things coming online where people are looking at ecosystem services and starting to pay for that. Carbon credits is a thing that is something that's going to be useful for some of these bioarchitectures, because the rate at storing carbon, can you get paid for that? And so those are the things that are going to enable these processes. So it's not just the biologists and the architects. You also have to work with the people that are trading carbon credits and creating policy for some of these things like ecosystem services, and try and get all of those ships aligned. So it's really complex, but the more you kind of put into a project, the more co-benefits you have, the closer it starts to look like nature.
Look, Chris, you mentioned the complexity. You spoke a lot about the convergence aspects of different disciplines coming together. There's another thing that I heard in what you were saying, just being aware of these issues, going out to Namibia, embedding yourself in the community. A lot of us talk about empathy, having empathy with different communities, with different problems. And it seems like that's something you've been doing. So I'm wondering, how did you get into that? How did you get plugged into those communities, become aware of these problems, and how might others engage in it in a similar way? So not be tunnel visioned in terms of particular business model or a particular problem that they're solving, look beyond what they're doing conventionally.
I think a lot of it had to do with the projects I had as an architect. I've always kind of wanted to use architecture and design as a method for creating, and some of the work that I did in Africa when I was working in New York at Studio MDA to create a boarding school for girls in Malawi was really influential on how I see architecture's contribution to society. And then I was a director at Mass Design Group, which is a humanitarian architecture organization based in Boston, but primarily working in Rome. I was the country director there. And seeing the ability for organizations like Mass and the projects we were doing in Malawi to transform people's lives was really something that was inspiring to me, addictive, I guess, in a way. Like, I wanted to keep doing that, to keep seeing that positive impact. But that stand side by side with some of these things like creating ecological damage by doing some of these projects. Even if we were using the most ecologically sustainable materials that we had at our disposal, that's not really good enough. We're still creating 40% of the world's carbon emissions in the buildings we're doing today. We have some estimates say that we're going to double the building footprint of the globe by 2060. So take every building in the world and then double that. Imagine how much building that's going to have to happen. And if we use the systems that we're using today, again, contributing to 40% of the world's carbon emissions, there's no way to get to carbon zero, to get to net zero with carbon. There's no way that we don't exacerbate all of the environmental disasters that are continuing to get worse on the planet. So I wanted to be able to pair this ability to create impact through the design and the architecture with the ability to actually look at things sustainably and get beyond sustainability, honestly, because I think we're well past that at this point. We need to get to regenerative architecture. And so that's where I see bioarchitecture as being the main driver for that, because we will have the ability to draw down carbon, but with our building materials, we will have the ability to remediate the built environment that we've created so toxically at this point. So we will start to be able to create environmental justice. A lot of these ill effects of architecture, industry, and banking are focused primarily on communities of color. And people are waking up to the fact now that there needs to be more justice in our environment in addition to sustainability. And so things like the BioCycler that targets some of the blighted communities here in Cleveland that have lots of toxicity as far as lead contamination, and convert those into healthy and safe and vibrant communities by literally recycling houses into houses that are now clean. That's where I see architecture performing justice.
Chris, so you mentioned a lot of other disciplines that are involved in this kind of regenerative architecture, regenerative society. You mentioned economics, policy, and connected to policy, there's always the issue of ethics, right? So when you have something like mycelium and biological entities that are in close proximity to humans, last time that we did, like moving to the agricultural revolution, and when we started herding animals and such, that was maybe the next big, or the previous big biological human interaction, we ended up with diseases and other things. Are there ethical issues that we need to take into consideration, and who's looking into those?
Yeah, I'm cognizant of the fact that I'm railing against monoculture, and at the same time, a lot of cultivation is a monoculture. I think it's a little taking the monoculture of plant production and reassociating it with the mycological part of that, the fungal part of that. And by pairing those two kingdoms together and making materials that are, at the end of the day, biodegradable and degradable in such a way that they're compostable so they can lead to healthier soils, I think that there's some redemption in that, but I'm constantly thinking about that, what you're talking about, and it does remain a major concern, because obviously we want to be as close to natural processes as possible, but here we are doing something very unnatural, which is kind of creating this monoculture of fungi in a place where naturally there would be a very diverse microbiome. But baby steps, I guess. I think this is towards a more natural system. And the fact that everything is organic and compostable is something to really kind of focus in on and see the co-benefits of that.
Yeah, I don't see, maybe I'm wrong here, but I don't see a lot of difference between that discussion and that argument versus desalinization of salt water for a population and limiting water resources, right? And I guess speaking of water, when we talk about green cities, the future of this type of material being used on planet and off planet, how does that compare? We were talking about the type of carbon emitters and just building the traditional kind of structures and everything. But when we're looking at that, we've talked about geoengineering, we've talked about other things that do bring up ethical considerations. Are there, to Vic's point, are there ethical considerations maybe we haven't thought about? Like, okay, well, it's going to require more water, or we're going to require something else because we're playing biology here and we're inserting humanity into this biosystem. Are there other things like that? There may be other ramifications of looking at this technology or this advancement over the next 50 years?
Well, yeah, I think we're just starting to scratch the surface as far as what technologies will come out of biomaterials or bioarchitecture. Or we've started talking about things like carbon storage. We've talked about bioperformative aspects like remediation and radiation protection if we're talking about off-planet. But there are other things, including repairing, self-maintaining products that will be I think, a future technology that will come along. And I don't think we're very far from something like a self-repairing material, because literally we've done this before where we've had materials that have broken and then we put them back together while they were still alive and they bio-welded themselves back together. So steel can't do that. Dead wood can't do that. But fungal materials can actually grow together and create their welded systems. There's also things like bioluminescence, which is just really cool to think about. But one of the things that I always kind of talk about is a future application of living architecture is, you know, how buildings have fire alarms. They detect that there's smoke in the building and then they'll alert you to that danger. Well, a living architecture could not only tell that, but may be able to tell us about pathogens in our environment. And not only tell us about that and alert us that there is a contagion, but may be able to attack it and protect us from certain things. So I think as we're learning and everyone's familiar with probiotic systems when it comes to our own health and the dangers of antibiotics and sometimes antibacterial soaps to create sterile environments, which are really just environments that enable pathogens to do better. Architecture, manufacturing, all of these things are kind of late to that game. And I think we're just in the point where we're realizing that maybe it would be good to have a probiotic architecture, or an architecture that's responsive to natural systems and that can not only alert us, but protect us from other competitors in nature.
Vic, does that get after, we've had some discussions with ethical considerations in AI, right, and in technology. But to me, this is a little bit more what it always comes back to me, like, what's humanity's purpose here on Earth and off Earth, right? And then where do we insert ourselves in the biome? Right? You were talking about prebiotics and probiotics and antibiotics, and we've come a long way in understanding, right? And there's been a lot of science over the years. But from a standpoint of where do we fit? And then our continual tension with, well, we think we're taking too much of these resources, or we're doing too much damage. I think there's this constant tension of how do we fit? And I think some people, I believe, think that planetary science and potentially living off planet of disgust is, okay, well, do we take some of those problems off planet? But then you're just taking those problems and putting them somewhere else, right? And especially if you want to go there later. And so it seems like we're just kind of struggling as a species to say, hey, we have this incredible ability to reason, right? Yeah. And then sometimes do we overthink it? Do we not think it enough? Do we work too much in a solitary way? Do we work enough in a convergent way? Do you see any of that in what you're working on here? From the ethical consideration that we've been talking about, it says we've talked about ethics and technologies, but this really comes to me just ethics and humanity writ large.
Yeah. I think a lot of times when I'm involved in a few startups right now, and one of the big words that comes up is scale. And so when you scale a system, that's when you really see the environmental effects of it. And if your system is fundamentally regenerative, when you scale that, you have the ability to actually start to turn the tide of some of the misdeeds of the past. And so imagine a plastic straw company. Plastic straws got a bad rap because of, how single use they are and they get disposed. But what if every straw that you used would absorb a ton of carbon? And how many straws would you use every day to kind of fight the carbon emissions that go on in the future? Now, that's just a theoretical example. But what if all the buildings that we make in the next 40 years, again, doubling the footprint we have now, instead of causing carbon emissions, we're actually all of that mass of those buildings were something that stored carbon. So now we're talking at a scale where the manufacturing can actually do a benefit to society, right? Because we're putting that carbon somewhere. We're keeping it out of the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide can go, and the way I see it, there are three major places you could put carbon dioxide. That's at the bottom of the ocean, which some people are promoting. Bury it deep in the ground or just slightly in the ground in the form of biochar. That's a good way to get rid of it. So you got water, you got the land. And now the third biggest thing there is infrastructure. And that's the thing that we are continually working on, making things. So why don't we make those things actually have a positive impact on the planet? And so if we have these materials that divert waste from landfills and convert them into positive attributes and store carbon, then we're talking that when we scale this operation, then we're starting to see some benefits that will happen worldwide. So I'm very optimistic, actually, about that we can turn things around, but we'll have to reduce carbon emissions. But I think there are going to be a lot of processes that come online that are actually sequestering carbon or storing carbon in ways that we can actually stomach. If it's about taking carbon and just burying it in the ground, it's not really doing it deep in the ground in these wells. It's not really doing anyone a service there. But if we can turn those into useful goods, then the capitalists start to get their interest peaked, and they're like, okay, we can turn this into stuff, we can sell that stuff. And so everybody wins here, and we can get folks with the means of production to come along. But when it comes to going off planet, I know you were referring to the concept that maybe we should take our pollution off planet and we should do heavy industry up there. But I see going off planet as an opportunity to be the giver of life, rather than that architecture can go, and if it's a bioarchitecture, it can go off planet and actually be something that spreads Mother Nature's silver to a new home. Whereas right now we see architecture as this, and building and manufacturing as this great destroyer of nature. And I think if we learn to harness nature in our manufacturing and our building, then we can actually turn that around, not only here on Earth, but as we go to other planets, we can start to expand nature. We can take nature with us, and that nature can really rebirth new planets.
That just hit a nerve with me, just because I know in the space industry where I'm working at, primarily seeing a lot, and you said startups, right? There's been a lot of startups around orbital debris and collision mitigation and this just a contested environment that space is becoming because of the commercial entrance into that environment. And had we maybe thought about some of these types of concepts first, you wouldn't have to worry about just maybe steel and nuts and bolts and then trying to figure out, okay, who's the garbage truck that's going to go pick this stuff up when it's outlived its useful life because it's not regenerative in nature. So there's some folks that are benefiting, obviously, from these new models and these new architectures. But we've really, to your point, we've just kind of taken what we've done here in building, and in building kind of the same mentality in this race to kind of commercialize the heavens. I love what you said instead, which is take the benefits of Mother Earth, right? The seed of nature, and then spread that instead, as opposed to these harsh metals and chemicals and everything we still have to figure out how to, just like we are doing here on Earth, trying to figure out how to get rid of those toxic materials when they've outlived their life.
I completely agree with what you're saying. And the other thing that came to mind when you're talking about using nature in a positive way, like the regrowth aspect of it, the word that came to mind was circular technology, so similar to circular economy.
Yeah.
But ironically, the regenerative part and the almost utopic post-scarcity world that you might be leading up to would probably put economists out of business, so they might not be too happy with that.
Yeah.
Leading to circular technology, leading to post-scarcity. I like that.
Yeah, there's a lot of vested interests that we'll probably struggle up against. But, you know, if we're able to demonstrate all of the co-benefits and placate the capitalists with carbon credits and things like that, then there's a way that we can get along here. And we can align the missions where it is a triple bottom beneficial. So it's creating, it's regenerative, but it's also lucrative because you're creating so many things from a waste material that you're turning nothing into something, and you can get paid for that. So I think there are ways that everybody wins here.
Yeah, I think we're still, when I was talking about 50 years away, I still feel like we're a little ways away. Unfortunately, just today I saw an article on Reuters about shoes that were supposed to be turned into rubber for tracks and things. And they had put some tag trackers in the shoes, and they found them in Indonesia and these far off points of the world. And they weren't really regenerating those as they had said they were going to do, repurposing these materials again after the useful life. And so I think we're a little ways away, unfortunately, but I think it comes back to, like you're saying, which is incentive structures and changing those incentive structures. And we've had this discussion with NASA previously about why aren't we off planet already? Right now, the leading elements of folks that have been kind of shepherding, if you will, these programs have profit-driven incentives. And we've always said the value of a profit-driven incentive is to create new innovations and new business opportunities, and that will be better than maybe other systems. And so, but we've also struggled with, well, if you have to have resources like hundreds of millions of dollars to launch a rocket and launch a green city into Mars, then you're just reducing the population set that can do that to a smaller number of people, right? Because they have the resources when you tie it strictly to capital, monetary. And so this idea of how do you incentivize all the systems here on Earth that are being utilized right now, benefits of each of those systems as people see them in new ways that can, like you said, triple bottom line.
Yeah.
I think it's going to be a key way from this for me, which is what are those incentive structures that go, that so you're not rolling the proverbial rock uphill.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's we're coming to the point where we're realizing the monetary damage that happens with environmental effects as well, too. So that starts to put things into focus. Typically, sometimes you completely ignore the environmental impact of a material. I make a concrete block and I sell that, and this is what it cost me to make it. But I don't really have any understanding or penalties for the carbon that I've released on the environment. I don't have any penalties. In some cases, the pollution that's caused by making things and the environmental injustice that happens to the neighboring community when I release PCBs into the rivers and things like that. Way to, I think, guard against that, or to your point about the shoes ending up in the wrong place and they were going to recycle that, but he screwed it up, is I think to make the materials in such a way that when they are done, the nature can recycle them. And so it's not something where you have to have a process that really recycles that. And so that's why when we do our materials, we purposely make the biodegradable, compostable. A lot of folks would say you need a more durable material, but we're just going to use this material for the structure, the insulation, and then we'll have some kind of weatherproofing material that goes over the mica materials. If we were to mix this with plastics or turn this into something that was naturally protected from the elements, then it would be non-biodegradable, and then we'd have that process. So it's really about separating those things out and making part of the building that can decompose sustainably, and the other part that can ideally be recycled in the form of like a metal roofing or something along those lines.
Yeah. But this has been fascinating today, Chris. I really appreciate it. But you can tell that you've taken theory, and because of your work in Africa, you've then applied it in a practical way, and you've got lessons learned in the application that are obviously relevant to every country here on Earth, as well as now NASA and off Earth. So kind of the key takeaway for me from today's discussion is moving past sustainability and this focus, this need to focus on regenerative technologies for how we build and live. Because again, whether that's underwater, on land, or out in the interstellar spaces,
yeah,
you know, that way is a much better way than just figuring out like, hey, we're just going to kind of build this and it's going to be useful for a little bit of time and then we're going to have to figure it out again, right? And we're not using a regenerative idea and concept behind it. So Vic, any key takeaways you're thinking about?
So yeah, I was just saying, I agree with you. I like the regenerative aspects that you brought up, the ecosystem perspective, that these bio-based technologies, whether it's bio-utilization or bio-inspired, that the connection that they bring with them to the broader ecosystem, whether it's the economics part of it, the societal part of it, and the potential for post-scarcity society, if we're able to grow our materials, our buildings, our structures. So currently, we're limited by energy, by food, by raw materials, and having these things being integrated and being able to grow them, not just on Earth, but in space, seems to paint a very positive future to me and gives us some hope. So appreciate that.
It's awesome. Well, Vic and Chris, thank you both for joining us today. Everyone else, join us for future episodes and explore technological advances like these and structural patterns that will help us better innovate, operate, and navigate in our increasingly connected world. Please subscribe to this podcast and you'll learn more at shoshaworks.com. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.